It's the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Famous Monsters of Filmland Magazine.
Welcome to the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Forrest J. Ackerman's classic magazine that started it all back in 1958. Often imitated, never duplicated, we're more than just monsters. We cover sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and all kinds of genre pop culture, living up to Forrest's classic roots while staying current and ahead of the curve.
My dad joined Starfleet because he believed in it. I joined on a dare.
You joined to see if you could live up to him. You spent all this time trying to be your dad. And now you're wondering what it means to be you.
I'm David Weiner, editor of Famous Monsters magazine, and that's a clip from Star Trek Beyond, the third film in the rebooted franchise shepherded by J.J. Abrams, beaming into theaters July 22nd and timed to help celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Star Trek franchise. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by the captain. Actually, it's my friends from Captured Oral Fantasy Theater, CAPT for short. Please welcome Ben Dicko.
Hey, how's it going?
And Nicole Ortega.
Hi there.
Are you guys Star Trek fans at all?
Yeah, totally.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm Star Trek fan, also Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
but I have a much appreciation for Star Trek. Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of feel the same way. I think that as a, you know, Star Wars hit right at the right point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But Star Wars at that time was only at the theater. So you got your sci-fi fix watching Star Trek reruns.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure.
Definitely.
Now, the real question, though, is would you guys consider yourselves Trekkies or Trekkers?
Hmm. I like Trekkie. It flows off the tongue better.
Yeah, Trekkies is better, I think.
Yeah, it's almost a trick question for some people. I think the ones who take themselves very seriously consider themselves Trekkers.
Right, right, right.
The ones who just sort of were there from the beginning, who didn't necessarily take themselves extremely seriously, mm-hmm. are Trekkies. I consider myself part of that camp.
Yeah, and that's, you know, Captain Oral Fantasy doesn't take itself seriously.
And that's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
That's You're why tricky. You guys are here, because
exactly.
the last thing I want to do is anyone to take this podcast very seriously. Well, today we're going to talk all things Trek, from the new movies to the original series and everything in between. But first, a preview of Star Trek Beyond. I interviewed Mr. Sulu himself, John Cho, for the new issue of Famous Monsters magazine, out now, to get a taste of what it was like to reunite the Enterprise crew under a new director, Fast and Furious franchise helmer Justin Lin, and also to discuss the dynamic of the screenplay now that Trek mainstay Simon Pegg got a chance to co-write the Beyond script with Doug Young. Our interview took place before the recent revelation that Cho's Sulu character is gay and that it made headlines. It also happened before the sudden tragic death of Anton Yelchin, who plays Chekhov in the new movies. In fact, this was Cho's first interview with any press about the film, so he was sometimes a little conflicted about what he was allowed to reveal. One of the later moments, it got to the point where I just joked, you know, can you confirm whether or not the Cloverfield monster makes an appearance in this film? That cracked him up. Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny. So here are portions of my interview with John Cho, who previously worked with director Justin Lin on the indie film Better Luck Tomorrow.
I know Simon Pegg has a different role this time around. Obviously, he's back as Scotty, but he was co-writing this film.
Oh, so great.
So that must have been an interesting dynamic because, you know, you have him, but he's also, you know, the screenwriter. Was he active on the set in terms of that?
Yes, he was. Funny, I sometimes get his trailer on a day he wasn't working, and his dry erase board in the trailer was filled with incomprehensible. It looked like the chalkboard from A Beautiful Mind. but it was emotionally, it was great for us to, again, that was some continuity for the cast. We felt very protected and taken care of. You know, we had somebody on the inside, as it were, and you know, we had an advocate and someone we loved who was in there looking out for us and explaining things to us, and he's great at sort of explaining. Sometimes actually reading unpacking a Star Trek script is difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot going on thematically. There's a lot of action direction that's tough to visualize sometimes, you know, because you're talking about things that that aren't real, you know. So it's and then there's keeping track of many characters and keeping those threads going, and it's a very dense read, and it's, for me, it's denser, so much, it's one of the most dense script reads there are. As an actor, it's sometimes difficult to comprehend everything you're supposed to comprehend in order to do your job, and so it was sort of great having Simon constantly available for that, and he and his writing partner Doug were terrific and available.
Did his sort of sensibilities and his observations and sense of humor, does that sort of feel like it's imbued a little more in this screenplay, or is it a bit of a step in a different direction in terms of kind of what he's known
it's
for?
It's not a comedy, but there are, to me, what you're going to get when you ask Simon Pegg to pen a script is a very human touch and a warm touch, and that can come out in comedy, but it doesn't necessarily have to, and there are some funny moments, but I think he and Doug, from what I could tell, were constantly looking for connections between the characters, and from our perspective, from the cast perspective, was what was spectacular about asking Simon to do it, Simon and Doug. It just felt like they were looking for human moments. You know, explain the question, what is it like to be with these people for this long, mm-hmm. doing this mission? And what happens with one another? We can extrapolate what, you know, we're going to run into new civilizations and cultures and enemies, but what is it like between the crew members? And I thought it was a great exploration of that question.
Kind of mirroring being on location for a long time away from your family.
I suppose so. I mean, there's a lot of, there's a bit of a feel. I sometimes wonder what it was like sometimes I'll wonder what it would be like to be an actor, you know, in another century, you know, when you go from town to town and put all your hats and shoes in the wagon and go to the next town and put up a show, and what that would be like. And in movies, you get that for little sprints, you know, little
right.
bursts of time. You know, but then when you do three movies together, it's sort of over years, it starts to feel intense, you know, and I do feel like we have a very, we just have strong bonds together, you know.
I know you've got a life and a family and a career, but, you know, do you get an opportunity to, you know, grab a drink or a bite with any of these folks in between movies?
Yes, you know, we don't do it as often as we should, but it happens on occasion. You know, there's always like a connector person that I've felt that in every group of friends is like the center of the wheel.
Sure.
And I feel like in this cast, it's Zach.
Hmm.
And my feeling is that we all kind of come together through Zach. He's the one that makes it happen.
The last Star Trek movie, I thought was very fun. But of course, you know, fans are very vocal. And it kind of got mixed reviews from some of the hardcore fans. And it is what it is. You work hard on something, you hope it's going to land, and you hope it's going to stick, and you hope it's going to resonate. But sometimes it just doesn't, and you can't please all the people all the time. So my question in relation to that is, you know, do you feel like third movie in on the franchise now, of the new franchise, does Star Trek have something to prove to anybody? Does it feel like you're trying to?
To me, this is just my personal opinion, and you'd have to ask the filmmakers what their goals were or what their opinions are. Those are the people that matter. But for me, I don't want the I feel kind of strongly about this, is that what we should be making is, and I think that's what the objective was, mm-hmm. is to make a Star Trek movie in the most complete sense of that phrase, and I hope we're not, you know, I don't think we should be making a movie that proves anything that goes against or disproves anyone. Or tries to, I don't think we should be making a movie that tries to grab a bigger audience or anything like that. I just feel like we should be staying true to the characters and the world that exist, and trying to make as rich and deep a story as we can. And, mm-hmm. and I hope we didn't try to prove anything else. Because the stuff that we're working with is very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've answered your question at all, but I there was something about the word prove. I just feel like we shouldn't overreact.
Are there conscious elements in the film that are kind of nods to the original franchise in that it is the 50th anniversary, or... You know, you're already making a Star Trek movie with all the original characters. That's enough.
I think so. I think the latter. But my first impression, and I've said this before, but this is honest. When I read the script, I thought that just my emotional impression was that it felt very much like the best of the original series.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of felt like it. I'm not exactly sure why, but it felt like those like the series felt to me. And the first one that we made didn't entirely feel like that to me. So this script, just on first read, it really felt like the series.
Pick up the new issue of Famous Monsters today for more of my interview with John Cho, plus a fun Star Trek 50th anniversary retrospective, including brand new Q&As with Nichelle Nichols,
cool.
a.k.a.
Yeah,
nice.
Lieutenant Uhura,
mm-hmm.
and also Rod Roddenberry, who's the son of Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry.
Oh, nice.
And he's very much the carrier of the Star Trek torch.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Cool. Oh, yeah. There's also a retrospective piece and timelines by veteran Trek writers Kevin Dillmore and Dayton Lord, who've written many, many a novel and working on other projects related to Trek. And there's also really fun breakdowns of favorite original series episodes and also monsters and aliens. Do you guys have any favorite monsters and aliens from Star Trek?
Oh, totally.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, obvious, the Gorn. I mean, who doesn't love the Gorn? I was watching it last night, and that episode is Arena.
Yeah, Arena. Right? Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And just that whole, the fighting choreography for yes. that, and how, and, yeah, the sound effects, whoever did that sound effect awesome. Is awesome. And just, you know, how he moves. And so when I was watching it, there's this part where they're in an arm lock.
Right.
And I was wondering, Kirk Shatner,
right.
like, do you have to be aware of how to hold on to this rubber suit?
Yeah, exactly.
His fingers are just going to squish into his
skin. Rip through the arms. Exactly.
You know, the thing I like about the Gorn are I like the eyes, the like sparkly.
Yes.
Sparkly
they kind of
eyes.
Look like microphones, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I bet they
do.
Are.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're super awesome.
If you look at the later, the blue, what is it, the Blu-ray or the HD mm-hmm. episodes,
yeah,
what
yeah.
do they
the
call
enhanced
them?
Ones?
They, yeah, the enhanced
yeah.
ones. They,
yeah.
They went all out and they made him blink every now and then.
Oh, did
oh,
they?
Nice.
Oh, I've never noticed that. That's
oh,
cool.
I got to check that
Which
out.
I think was a pretty good enhancement because I think if you did anything more to that suit, you would basically detract from how cheesy and amazing that was.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I just could never figure out where the guy, let's, you know, pull back the veil. There was a human inside that outfit, right?
What? Oh, you just blew my mind.
I know. Sorry. But where that guy was looking out from, because the eyes are completely solid. It's not like they're like a mesh or anything.
Well, he,
like
if you
that.
Look at his nose, he kind of has sort of like these nostrils
yeah.
that
yeah,
I think that's
so.
Pretty much, you know, you can see Shatner breathing in
yeah.
front of him there.
Maybe that's why he was walking so slow.
Absolutely. Yeah. He didn't want to, you know, they took his walker away right before they'd say, action. No, that's absolutely one of my all-time favorite episodes
yeah,
how,
yeah.
And favorite villains.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm convinced that he makes that
yeah.
sound like, because mm-hmm. he just can't breathe in that.
No, exactly.
He's really hacking in that suit.
Exactly. Ben, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I really like the salt vampire mm-hmm. creatures, yeah. the ugly ones. I always thought those things were freaky when I first saw them when I was a kid. Totally reminded me of the Morlocks from A Time Machine.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Deep nerd. it's just super great. And I wouldn't be surprised because they used to swap effects and, you know, costumes all the time at, you know, 50 years ago. So
right.
I wouldn't be surprised if some of that stuff from Time Machine made it into
something. Yeah, I'm sure at least some of that stuff was all interchangeable. Mm-hmm. You know, they basically mm-hmm. walk around the Paramount lot saying, all right, we have no time and
I'll
no
take
budget.
One of those.
Oh, wait, what's that sitting in the dumpster?
Exactly.
Now, those salt vampires, they would suck the salt out of the
yeah.
humans?
That was their thing.
Or creatures? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it lives and dies by salt. Nice. But it's also a metamorph. It could change.
Right.
So it's under the guise of the doctor's beautiful wife,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right, exactly.
And okay. Kirk, you know, makes the moves.
Of course.
And almost
exactly. And what a better way to try to kill Kirk by sucking on him.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right?
Sucking the salt out
nice.
Of his mouth. All the other alien ladies do, so
exactly.
this one was a little more deadly.
I have to say, too, that I always liked the sort of weird ethereal creatures,
mm-hmm.
Like the, I think like the Tholians.
Yeah,
they
the
were,
Tholian
yeah,
web.
And they kind of just show up on the screen. You never see much more than some like eyes and stuff like that. Yeah, just the things that are just these sort of amorphous things, because I thought it was nice that not everything had to be humanistic
mm-hmm,
or human
mm-hmm.
humanoid.
Which I think was also a problem of later Trek.
Sure.
Later Trek, it was basically, you know, how can we creatively just put another forehead on their
exactly.
cheek, you know? And so I always thought, you know, the original one where, you know, you definitely did this, I mean, there was that rock creature.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
sure,
the
sure,
Excaliburs.
Sure. Right.
He was definitely a favorite of mine.
Totally.
They never went with that with the later episodes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about Next Generation
yeah.
the other
yes.
the other shows. I mean, every now and then, you know, like if you talk about Voyager, you know, they did create
right.
that one species, which is pretty much the CGI species.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I mean, trying to keep it with original Trek,
yeah.
I think that they were super creative given their super
absolutely.
Low budget.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, totally.
Definitely. And it would be pretty cool to see the Excaliburs now in this like techie world, like how would they create this
right,
right,
this
right. exactly
creature?
Yeah.
Whereas back in the day, just
well, there is kind of a rock monster in Galaxy Quest. Have you ever
oh,
seen
that's
Galaxy
right.
Quest?
Yes, the rock, uh-huh.
And you kind of you know it's not it's a giant thing, you
right.
know. But I think Tim Allen kind of decidedly ends that with a swift kick in the rocks.
Yeah.
In that one.
You know, I had read a long time ago that, you know, so Shatner directed Star Trek V, which, you know, It's a Star Trek movie.
Let's
just say that. And at the end, he really wanted like 50-foot tall rock monsters, like a dozen of them, to fight each other on that planet. And so they made one of them and did like test footage, and Paramount said, nope. No way, Jose. That's not going to happen.
We're going to go back to that. What does God want with a starship? And right, exactly. It's going to be a guy with a beard and a white flowing robe. Exactly. And there's your budget. But I would also say of the original series, one of my all-time favorites is the Mugatu.
Oh, yeah.
Which is basically a guy in a white gorilla suit.
Totally.
And they gave him a horn.
But, yeah.
You know, as a
freaky
kid.
Freaky looking.
Yeah, he makes a sound that's really like a sort of a scream, screech kind of thing. And
exactly.
That always wigged me out as a kid. And I found that to be extremely compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff.
You know, moving forward also into Next Generation territory, which is probably... You know, this is Trek 50, right? So we can talk about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, Star Trek Next Generation suffered from a lot of humanoid species, which there's also a theory about that, right? That there's this sort of, there's a Trek theory about sort of how evolution works in the universe, and that's why you have so many bipedal, two-armed, one-head kind of creatures.
But that's a side note. That's convenient, but
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But one thing that I liked is that they did a lot of light creatures. So, you know, there were these ethereal creatures in the, you know, the original series that were these smoke creatures and stuff like that.
Right.
But in Next Generation, a lot of things would just sort of devolve into, like, its energy essence. And
right,
just be
exactly.
This light that went away.
Which is
kind of cool.
Classic
yeah.
Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, who loves the Tribbles? Those are kind of cool.
That's true.
Yeah, you can't talk space aliens and Star Trek creatures without the Tribbles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a definite favorite of mine. I also want to make sure that we mention the Horta.
Oh, yeah,
Which is also one of my favorite episodes. Actually, Rod Roddenberry was telling me that that's one of his favorite episodes as well, because that was he was actually growing up as the son of Gene Roddenberry. You'd think he'd know everything Trek, but he actually kind of rejected Trek.
Really?
Yeah, and his Trek was really the Next Generation.
Sure.
He never really watched Dad's old show that Dad was famous for, because he never quite got that from the inside looking out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But you know, when he realized sort of the magnitude of what his father represented as a icon of science fiction,
absolutely,
as opposed to just Dad.
Right.
He started watching episodes, and the first one that really made a major impact was that episode with the Horta, which is called,
really?
I can't remember what's it called, Devil
in
the
Dark.
And, you know, that's this amazing episode where there are these miners and they're being killed by a monster. And you think to yourself, wow, okay, that's, you know, it's a good episode, you know. There's the Kirk and Spock and the crew and the red shirts all get eaten by the Horta. But it kind of twists your expectations on your head, and you've got these little silver orbs that they're mining that turn out to be this poor creature's babies.
Exactly.
It's their eggs.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I remember he said that was the first time he really recognized the amazing writing on the show.
Absolutely,
that it was very, very, very thought provoking.
Well, I mean, you know, transitioning into writing, Harlan Ellison. You know, my favorite episode. I have a lot of well loved episodes from the original series, but City on the Edge of Forever is just that's the best.
That's pretty much you know, recognized as the all time classic.
Yeah, and I know it's that. And then from Next Generation, I love Inner Light, which is also a recognized classic. But they are great. They're super fantastic.
Well, what is it about City on the Edge of Forever that resonates with you personally?
Well, I remember,
other than a hot Joan Collins.
Yeah, right. Well, again, going back to, like, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, you didn't have this onslaught of science fiction all the time. So I would catch Star Trek on reruns. And, you know, a lot of it was, you know, lasers and phasers and stuff like that was great. And then this one didn't have a lot of that. It was very, very thought provoking. I like the time travel aspect and stuff like that. But the that last... There's always that sort of joke at the end of all the Star Trek episodes. You know, Shatner says something.
Ah, and then they all laugh
exactly.
And it freeze frame.
Exactly. It's the classic 60s. But this one, not at all. He's dead serious. He's like, let's get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
This is too much.
He's a little shell-shocked.
Yeah. So I think that was probably the first TV sci-fi that made me feel like, oh, there's more going on here than meets the eye.
Yeah. Interesting.
Do you have a favorite episode?
Actually, my favorite episode is Amok Time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that vividly from childhood.
That's the one where Spock, he feels the urge every 7 years of Pun-far.
Yeah, it's just a great
and he's
got
to head back to Vulcan to what?
You know? Just He's got to do it. He's got to do it with, what's her
name?
You've got to wait
7 years. I suppose that you've earned it, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's a great plot line. Like, hey, Kirk takes her, so he can get it on.
He hijacks an entire spaceship. That's fantastic.
And not only that, but I am more of a visual person. Mm-hmm. So watching that scene when they're fighting Spock and Kirk, and just the cuts of them fighting and cutting to McCoy and then cutting to T'Pring.
Right, all the reactions.
And then the music.
Amazing music.
Yeah, it's amazing music. I mean, everybody loves that scene.
Oh, yeah.
Cable Guy did an homage to it. You know?
Yeah, between that and the gamesters of Triskelion, all you have to do is like...
I mean, Jim Carrey does it best. Besides the original.
Well, it's great. It's also this amazing, just sort of emotional build by watching it.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember watching that and thinking to myself, but they're friends. And Spock seems to be just so determined that how important that this is to him, that he's willing to kill Kirk for it.
Right.
And of course, you know,
junior high school, we all had times like that where you're with your best friend and then you both want the same girl and you're like, hey, man, or whoever.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
Well,
that's great. And I mean, you know, I think, I don't know, I guess we could spoil episodes to a certain degree. You know,
you mean 50-year-old episode?
Yeah, 50-year-old episode. I guess the statute of limitations might be over by now. But that's the one where Kirk dies.
Yeah, yes. Right. Exactly.
Not really. But as a kid and you're watching that, I'm just that to me, I could not believe.
Right.
That blew my kiddie mind.
Totally.
Because you can't kill Kirk. Absolutely. And there he is. Spock killed him. He's dead. And that's it. You know.
Did you say out loud, like, what? What's going on?
I did. And my mom rang the dinner bell and I said, no, I cannot. I have to see what happens. Don't make me go to the dinner table.
It's such a better death, too, than his actual death. And what is that? Just in Generations, right? Or something? The movie Generations.
Yeah.
Just an un...
He just kind of... The bridge broke and he flew off and...
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Totally ridiculous.
Yeah. Star Trek, to me, it's also a very, very nostalgic thing. I grew up in the 70s, and so for me, Star Trek was something that, because it was in syndication, I got to watch that every single night before dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Before that dinner bell would ring, it fit perfectly while my mom was making dinner.
Mm-hmm.
She was happy to have you just sitting and not making trouble watching Star Trek.
Right.
And so I have tremendously fond memories of just watching every single episode over and over and over again. And I remember I used to justify watching it sometimes to my mom, saying, I learn words when I watch Star Trek. I know what logical means. I know what fascinating means. It's an educational show, Mom. So I think she was already converted, but it was important to me to try and justify it.
That's good.
Nice.
Well, not to be too personal, but what the heck? That's what we're doing, right? It's an intermittent. It's an inner.
We've talked about pun far. Everything is personal.
Exactly. You know, that was definitely for me, like, you know, growing up as a little kid. But then Next Generation, that was the one that hit me right in high school. My parents were splitting. I ended up watching a lot with my dad and stuff like that. And it was, you know, that was good writing too. Totally got me back into it. In fact, this is the 50th anniversary. I remember being at the 25th anniversary Star Trek convention.
Oh, wow.
In either the... outside of Chicago in the Rosemont Ramada or the Holiday Inn. Oh, yeah, with my dad. He and I went. Oh, yeah. The geek goes
of course,
at least a couple generations. Yeah. I bought a little Star Trek pin.
Well, the real question is, did you cosplay in any way, shape, or form?
No, but I did buy a pin.
You were too cool for that.
Oh, absolutely. Of course. Of course.
It's funny. I remember the first Star Trek convention I went to was in Pasadena.
Oh, no.
And I was at a point in my life where, I always loved Star Trek, but, you know, on the exterior, you have to be cynical. I was just like, I'll go, I suppose. I just want to see what it's like. I'll just hang out for like an hour and then I'm going to go. And I remember going... wishing that I had like a Star Trek shirt or Spock ears.
Well, you didn't have it under your shirt?
Well, I should have, because when I got there, I felt, I was just like, oh, boy, I'm missing out, because everyone's dressed like a Klingon and an Andorian and an alien, or Kirk and Spock or anything in between, Uhura, and I felt like I completely missed the boat.
And it's hard to underestimate, like, you know, like Star Trek fandom has been such, it basically invented fandom. You know, so Fori maybe invented cosplay and invented, you know, cons and stuff like that, but they really took it up a notch with the Star Trek fandom.
Oh yeah,
and really, all of the roots of everything we have today go back to those little geeks. But it's true, like cosplay, all that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. I had an uncle who was way older, you know, obviously way older than me. But he had a phaser, an original phaser mm-hmm. from the merchandising from the original series.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And I used to play with that thing all the time. It was the greatest. And you having that in your hand, thinking like, oh, I could make a shirt.
Wait,
or
he
whatever.
Gave you a live weapon?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Oh. Exactly. Used to annihilate whatever. The cats down the street. Yeah, exactly.
He said, son, set this on stun, whatever you
exactly,
do.
Exactly, right.
Do not aim at the neighbor's cat.
That's right. That's right. But it was awesome. It was great. It was, I think the influence of Trek, more than just, you know, all of this other stuff, is just the world that it created around it as far as the geek world.
Well, talking about Next Generation, I don't know if you guys remember, I don't remember the context of the actual trial, but there was a trial, a very public national attention on a trial going on. And there was a woman who was one of the jurors, she was a juror, and she went and dressed in Next Generation uniform single day, complete with like a phaser,
a tricorder. Yeah. Wow.
And she made it on the jury, and she said, I'm not nuts, I'm just a very devoted fan.
Yeah.
And I live by the tenets of Starfleet, and it's all about upholding justice and being fair, and mm-hmm. this is what I find important. And you know, everyone thought she was a loon, but she actually had she was probably more well adjusted than some of those other people
right.
on the jury.
Oh, right, sure, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, then the whole probably around the same time, the Let's Learn Klingon and, you know, mm-hmm. do Shakespeare in Klingon. That was a big thing in the early 90s.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Yeah, I remember Klingon summer camp. You can go to and stuff like that.
I'm sure there's an app for that,
I couldn't
right?
get
oh,
into
yeah,
that.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, now totally app. Yeah.
Now, when I say I couldn't get into it, they didn't have any reason.
Of course.
So do you guys have a favorite Star Trek movie out of all the films, whether it's the original series, whether it's Next Generation, or whether it's the J.J. Abrams, now three movies in?
Mm-hmm. Three movies in. I would have to say Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm.
One, Ricardo Montalban. I mean, geez. I mean, this guy is... I mean,
how about those abs?
Yeah, right? Montalban is just... I mean, he's just a presence of his own.
Oh, absolutely.
And in this character, I mean, he's just awesome. I've met him once, and... you just hear the voice.
Oh, my gosh.
That's gone.
Did you talk to him and say, please say rich Corinthian? You know, I very specifically remember when Wrath of Khan was coming out, and I heard that Mr. Rourke from Fantasy Island
was
the bad guy. I had completely forgotten that he'd played Khan in the original series as one of the much more compelling bad guys. And so I remember thinking to myself, really? They put Mr. Rourke in this movie? But I remember watching it just from the opening scene when, you know, he puts that creature into Chekhov's ear, Paul Winfield's ear.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. He was a force to be reckoned with.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, you know, like in 82 when that came out, there was no – you couldn't just like – get on Netflix and watch the original Space Seed. It was like, holy crap, they're calling back to that thing. And maybe it'll be on TV in a couple years or something like that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I wanted to watch that since we were coming here today. I didn't have a chance to see that, but I was watching the trailer. I watched it like three times. Mm. Just the trailer alone, it's so good and it just sucks you in. Mm-hmm. Like, I have to see that. Like, when I get home, I'm going to go watch it.
Oh, we have
it's
to.
Just,
yeah.
The trailer is just awesome. And, I mean, Montalban, he's just an awesome actor.
And I also love the Reliant, the design of the ship. One of the things that I love about Star Trek, or what I love about Star Trek, is the design and the fleshed outness of the world. Mm-hmm. So I really would get into the technical stuff and I read the technical manuals and stuff like that. But the Reliant, I always thought was the awesomest. Like, it was the sleekest, the coolest looking maneuverable Federation ship that we
had. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time you see that, too, you think it's the Enterprise.
Yeah, exactly.
It looks like it in the beginning, and then the shape immediately changes. But I remember watching that movie And I totally geeked out on it.
Sure.
Because in retrospect was saying, wait, Chekhov is the guy who's saying, Botany Bay, Botany Bay, we need to go, we need to go.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember, you know, the big hoopla about that was like, well, you know, Chekhov was not in that episode.
Right.
But then all the, you know, all the Trekkies and the Trekkers and the hardcore people were like, well, he was on the ship. He just wasn't, you know, he wasn't on duty during all that.
And
we just didn't see what was going. It was his day off. Or maybe he had short leave or something like that, you know, being chased by giant white rabbits.
Yes, exactly. Ooh.
Now, is that chess piece somewhere?
His chess piece?
I thought that was real. What?
You're saying his pecs are not real in that movie?
I mean, he's a very athletic and fit guy at that time.
I'm sure the Smithsonian has it.
Yeah, well, it probably has crumbled a little bit. And it probably smells like rich Corinthian leather. Well, one of the cool things about that, I mean, that really is sort of the go-to movie of
course,
all the Trek movies that is really the standard that everything is held to, including Star Trek Into Darkness, which you know, completely called back for better or for worse to Wrath of Khan.
Right.
And Nicholas Meyer, who directed that,
he was
pretty much the guy that they bring him in to save.
Exactly.
You know, after Star Trek V came along and Shatner had his swing at bat and, you know, got everyone to sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. And they brought Nicholas Meyer back to say, you know, let's do one last hurrah with the original cast and make it serious again. And they've got now that new, the new series that CBS is doing that Brian Fuller is the showrunner for.
Mm-hmm.
They brought Nicholas Meyer back for that as well. And boy, if that doesn't sell any Trek fan on
absolutely.
Nothing's going to, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I agree. I haven't really heard too much about it. I mean, there's just that one trailer that's the logo,
it's very brushed metal.
Yeah,
very so that you can read anything you want because we know nothing.
Exactly.
But all I can say is that brushed metal, that means metal, there's some edge to it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the real question is, you know, will you pay to? You have to pay to see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You get the first episode free, and then you have to, you know, kind of like Netflix or Showtime
or
HBO
heroin.
Go or heroin.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you make a very good point.
See?
We can't live without it, can we?
Right.
So you guys are definitely convinced. You know, I'm bouncing around a little bit, but I wanted to talk about in terms of original sort of happy nostalgic memories of Star Trek. I wanted to throw in for me one of the great moments of my childhood, other than running around, you know, being Captain Kirk and playing with the Mego dolls and having the Mego playset. I lived in New York. I grew up in the suburbs of New York. And back then, other than those AMT models and the Mego dolls, you really didn't have anything for Star Trek. There's just no merchandising.
Right.
And there was some stuff out there, but it was so limited.
Mm-hmm.
There was a store called the Federation Trading Post,
which was
created by fans of the series. And who one of them, the name escapes me, but ended up being a makeup effects worker and consultant on subsequent Trek shows.
Cool.
But it was basically like this sort of tiny little store in the middle of New York it was the only place that you could,
awesome.
This is before you could just watch it on video. So
you'd
walk into the store. My memory is my parents surprised me by going there. So we would go into the city to have dinner often.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't a big deal. And I remember walking down the street and I just kept walking and they all stopped and they said, David, look over there.
Aww.
And there was like a shining beacon of light,
the
Federation
awesome.
Trading Post. And you walk in and there's like a giant barrel of tribbles that you could buy.
No way, that's great.
You know, when I say there's no video, you could listen to an entire episode.
Yeah.
They were just playing the audio on the speakers above you. You can get uniforms. You can get the little insignia to, you know, put a patch on your shirt.
Mm-hmm.
You can get models. You can get anything and everything. You can get original scripts. And this was something that the love of the fans was clearly there.
Absolutely.
Some of the original Star Trek actors would sometimes pop by and
you'd
see these great photos because they were still kind of blown away. They're like, wait, that show that I worked on that got canceled? Wait, it's more popular now? So, let me get this right. People are dressing up like Spock? What are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it was kind of the beginning of the renaissance of Star Trek
totally.
And the fact that we're talking about the 50th anniversary now with a new movie,
it's
a
amazing.
New series coming on. It's just really kind of hard to believe.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, is that store there?
I think it's long gone, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's long gone. But there's so much merchandising now.
Oh, you know,
the
yeah.
store,
oh,
absolutely. There's a store called eBay where you can get
really eBay. I gotta look that up.
You can get all sorts of stuff.
What a great memory, though. That's super nice. Yeah. That you posted that. Do you remember what was that a birthday or something?
That was just the greatest Tuesday. Day of my life. It doesn't matter. No, it was a Tuesday. It was like a Saturday afternoon. And it's funny when, you know, I mean, I was a kid. I was probably only, you know, eight, nine years old mm-hmm. tops. And so I remember, you know, had I had a wallet packed with cash, I would have mm-hmm. walked oh, away yeah. with a oh, lot yeah. more. And it's yeah. funny, I think about that opportunity. And I just think I walked away with a tribble from that barrel
nice.
O' tribbles, which I still have. And, that's it. That's the only thing. It was sort of like one of the things, like, Mom, can I buy us one thing? Yeah, yeah. Yes, you can have one thing. And they secretly bought me a cool Star Trek jacket, and they bought me one of the little insignias. And when I say secretly, they did it right in front of me. But I was so distracted that I just was like, I'm just in Mecca right here, and I will absorb as much as I can until they walk me out.
That's super cool.
I'm still walking on air when I think about that memory.
That's awesome.
What a great memory.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Do you have, going back to the movies, yeah. do you, Ben, have a favorite film?
Yeah, well, I mean, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, definitely a great one. But I find myself watching the motion picture a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The older I get. I remember when it first came out, I saw it at the theater.
When you start moving a little more slowly.
Yeah, well, that's the criticism, right? Yeah, exactly.
Don't give your age away.
No, I'm a hater. But I remember, this is going to give it away, but I remember seeing it in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting the Happy Meal.
Yes.
The Happy Meal Star Trek motion picture.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, that was like one of the first great Star Trek Happy Meals.
Yeah, of course you are.
You were a zygote at the time, exactly. I think.
But I remember, you know, walking out of it with my dad and thinking, it was slow, definitely. I didn't know how to put it into words as a kid, but that was what I was reacting
right.
to. But I was also a big space NASA nut, and the idea that the Voyager spacecraft, which I had been, you know, kind of following.
Oh, you knew about the Voyager spacecraft.
That this... Holy crap, what? That thing went out there and then they brought it back. That's super awesome.
Yeah, it's basically for those who aren't, you know, again, a spoiler for a movie from 1979.
Exactly.
Basically, the entire movie revolves around the concept that Voyager went out into deep, 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 deep space
right.
and an alien culture basically picked it up and enveloped themselves around it.
Right.
In the concept of learning and obtaining as much information. And basically, they just wanted to find their creator.
Right, exactly.
And they called itself V'ger because the Voyager...
Had been rubbed off.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it was just the V and the G-E-R was the only thing that wasn't sort of, brushed metal
right.
off.
Yes, that's right. But, the part that, besides that, you know, that sort of storyline, the part that I love the most is the reveal of the refit Enterprise. Like, I can watch that sequence. It's 5 minutes, I think, mm-hmm. and Kirk and Scotty flying in that shuttle, and just the way that they shot that was just fantastic.
It's Enterprise porn.
Absolutely.
Really
absolutely.
Lovingly.
Can we say porn?
Absolutely. Yeah, we can in this one. Just in this context.
And the shuttle
docks.
We're
not going to talk about later adaptations.
Okay. The shuttle docks
or
do it
fiction.
At the end, you know. Yeah. But yeah, it's that was just so cool. And so, yeah, that is definitely a scene that I've thought of, maybe I'll watch that scene tonight.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Jerry Goldsmith music was so spectacular.
Absolutely.
And I remember thinking, well, where's the Star Trek theme? And then it didn't matter because
mm-hmm.
it was so
exactly.
well done. And it was
exactly.
so great.
Yeah.
That's a movie for me also. I remember watching, you just wanted it to be like the series, but I was so young that that's what they gave me and that's what I watched.
Absolutely.
And I don't remember thinking to myself, I'm bored. I just remember thinking, well, when's something going to happen?
Right.
But I was so in awe with all the stuff that would be lovingly detailed in terms of inside V'ger and all these amazing production design and shots and design conceptual stuff that it was fine. And mm-hmm. I have found myself going back many a time mm-hmm. because it sort of sits in its own little time capsule.
Totally.
Because they're, it's hard to believe now because when we watched it, we're like, well, you know, that series was so long ago.
Right.
But it was only a decade later.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know? So these guys are still young and in their prime, but they're slightly more mature.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Roddenberry wanted he wanted basically 2001 A Space
Absolutely.
Odyssey instead of Star Wars.
Right. And I think that the director, Robert Wise, too, like, there you have legendary director, Day the Earth Stood Still, mm-hmm. like basically an author of, a visual author of what sci-fi is all about, taking on Star Trek. You could definitely see that was the sort of auteur hand going mm-hmm. on in there. But yeah, I thought the production design of that is great. Super 70s, but like but very unique.
Yeah,
right?
Shatner's got a bit of a fro going.
Oh, so. Everything. Yeah. The V-neck thing that McCoy wears.
Yeah,
is hilarious.
That's great. Well, you know that though. In context, I think also is why everyone loved Wrath of Khan so much. Wrath of Khan stands on its own in any context, but. In comparison to Star Trek the Motion Picture coming after that, when Star Trek came back, you're like, wait, they've got a whole set of uniforms that are different. Yeah. They're promising a lot more action. I mean, I remember just the advertisements in you know, like a 2-page spread in a magazine, probably in Dynamite magazine. I don't know.
Starlog.
Yeah, Starlog. Exactly, Starlog. But it was it promised something like, please come back and check it out because this is the Star Trek you know and love. And and it just blew everything away.
Which honestly is not unlike the reboot in 2009. Like I felt like, the beginning of Wrath of Khan, it even has a short Enterprise porn scene too.
Yep.
It was really a reboot after the whatever misstep the first one was.
Sure.
And so then you come back to 2009 and rebooting the whole series and things like that. I thought it was interesting. It was an interesting take.
Also, a great, great score by James Horner.
Totally.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
He did Star Trek 3, 2. He did Star Trek 2 and 3 as well.
Oh, okay.
But going to the JJ stuff, I was just so happy that Star Trek at the point that the JJ, what was it, 2009?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When it first came out. At that point, I think the series had kind of run their course and were kind of losing their inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And as a longtime Trek fan, I tried every single series. I watched Generation, I watched Deep Space Nine, I watched Voyager, I watched Enterprise. But truthfully, Generation is the only one that I really stuck with. The rest I kind of watched a little bit. Mm-hmm. I came back trying harder, but ultimately I just couldn't stick with them.
Yeah, me too.
So the fact that they were going back to basics, well, you couldn't quite wrap your mind around how could they recast Kirk.
Right.
You know, how could they recast Spock and McCoy?
Right.
You know, this could be awful.
Right.
But I think what they did was they were wise enough to go back to the original production design, original characters, but by creating this different timeline, whether you love it or hate it, at least they gave themselves carte blanche to kind of write their own story.
Definitely. Yeah, I thought that was the best decision they made. Because I have to say, when first, then the build up to the Star Trek 2009, I was not looking forward to it. I thought if you're going to do like the origin of this team, it's fine. I understand that you have to recast. That's cool. Mm-hmm. And I thought they did a great job with the casting. But I was like, I want to see that sort of design from the early Starfleet,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I want to see those primary colors and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, the zany tech person fan of me was kind of, that's what I was rebelling against. But then, I saw the movie and I was like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
And the whole, the timeline thing totally made, of course it doesn't, the doors don't make the same noise because it's a totally different timeline.
Exactly.
Of course. All right, I'm good.
2009.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to add real quick that that's always the challenge when you redo something is you don't want to do it exactly the way it was, but
no, you
want
don't.
To mirror it to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. So I challenge anybody who says, well, it's not what I want. It's not what I wish it could be.
Right.
I challenge anybody to try and not redo the same exact thing yet keep elements the same. And and as J.J. Abrams has demonstrated both with
Twice.
Star Trek and with Force Awakens, he can take what is important and what's cool and what people connect with from an original franchise and then sort of take a few steps forward and make it original yet familiar.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I was going to say, that I'm not a big fan of reboots, but it happens. We all know it happens.
It's a reality.
It's a reality. But
every 3 minutes, a reboot is born.
Exactly.
There'll be a reboot of this. No, the cast was great. I thought, like you said, adding the elements to the old Star Trek, and also what Simon Pegg was saying. Like, I read some article about him, how this whole Sulu thing and of him being gay
coming out,
and. But you want to add your own creativity, your own twist to your reboot, your movie.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So nobody wants to see the same thing over again.
Yeah.
So
I think briefly to that point also, people were saying that George Takei, it's a nod to George Takei, who's obviously later in life came out. But the irony of that discussion is that George Takei said, well, I actually wish they didn't have Sulu come out as gay because it sort of... for lack of a better word, warps what nice. Gene Roddenberry intended. You know, mm-hmm. Gene Roddenberry intended that to be a heterosexual character.
Right.
Argue all that you want, all that you wish. It's an alternate timeline.
Yeah,
it's a nod to the diversity of Star Trek. You know, Star Trek has always been
and
very
how it's still
forward.
Evolving with that diversity, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it pushed envelopes 50 years ago, and more envelopes are opening up, you know, 50 years on. So
definitely.
It keeps
with the kiss.
With yeah.
Yeah, the absolutely. Interracial kiss, mm-hmm. you know, between, you know, Kirk and Uhura. But it was always a multicultural crew, multi-ethnic, multicultural, totally. Different, you know, from different parts of the world who were always working together in harmony. And there was never, ever, ever a mention of skin color or origins.
You know, I know that, you know, in the movies, the rule of thumb is the even-numbered movies are always the better ones.
Right.
Which I don't know. In the reboot, doesn't seem to be quite the case. Maybe, but
yeah, it was. Now it's odd numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to 1 and 3.
It's a true reboot. Yes. Right? But you know, Star Trek 3, kind of, you know, because it's a transition. It's mm-hmm. really 2, 3, and 4 are the same story. It's just broken up.
Star
right?
Trek 3, the search for
search
Spock.
Search for Spock. Yeah. Exactly. I thought it was interesting. Two things. One, the first time that we get to see Space Doc in that big. You know, that huge space station that you can fly into and out of.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting how they may have been trying to recreate the cantina scene from Star Wars.
Oh,
with
right.
That. And then also
I like how you gingerly said mayhave.
Mayhave, exactly.
Mayhave. Yeah, they pretty much do.
And then the Enterprise is destroyed, which it looks like in Beyond the same thing happens.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm wondering if there are callbacks in the new movie to that movie in particular because of that. You know, the destruction of the Enterprise.
Well, it seems like, you know, arguably people get a little destruction fatigue because mm-hmm. they like to sort of destroy the Enterprise every two
exactly.
movies
right,
now
right.
so they can get a new design. They did that in Star Trek Generations.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, this one, again, they're destroying the Enterprise, so I guess we get a new one at the end. Or,
yeah.
You know, we'll see a new one in Star Trek 4 if and when that comes around.
Right.
But it looks pretty cool. And
oh,
the destruction of this looks pretty intense.
Oh, absolutely.
But you really have to go back to Star Trek 3 because the destruction of the Enterprise in that movie was an emotional destruction.
Absolutely.
It was a extremely, of course.
Because they did it themselves. That's the thing, too. Like, they hit the self-destruct. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's a very well-crafted scene because mm-hmm. there's a lot of elements taking place. And it's a lot of callback to the Kobayashi Maru.
Sure,
situation
right.
of Star Trek II. And this film, which marks Leonard Nimoy's directorial debut Star Trek films, it's a great moment because, mm-hmm. you know, in Star Trek II, Kirk learns that he has a son.
Right.
And as soon as he gets an opportunity to get to know his son to a certain degree, his son is dramatically taken mm-hmm. away. Mm-hmm. And it's such a great moment because they're lost. They've lost.
Yeah.
And they have to destroy the Enterprise because they have no choice, and it's the only way that they basically get out of their situation.
Right.
And there's that wonderful moment where they're just watching the embers of the Enterprise, you know, just sort of burn up mm-hmm. in the atmosphere. And, mm-hmm. and Kirk is like, McCoy, what have I done?
Right, exactly.
You know, McCoy's like, you've done what you always do. You turned death into a fighting chance to live.
Right.
I think I totally got that.
That's pretty
wrong.
Much the same. That's right. That's good. Sentiment.
But that's pretty much it, you know, and that's one of the great things that I loved about all the original movies mm-hmm. and the original series that I hope that Star Trek Beyond mm-hmm. Capitalizes on, and it looks like they're doing that based on what John Cho told me about Simon Pegg is bringing the family back.
Oh,
the family
good. Yeah,
element,
yeah, yeah.
Star Trek has always been about family, about relationships,
yeah.
and about friendship.
Yeah.
And I do believe that in the J.J. Abrams, the first one, Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, there was a lot at stake, and there was a lot emotionally at stake. But I think the sort of the friendship of the crew, especially that sort of triumvirate of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, mm-hmm. and even just those intimate moments of Kirk and McCoy when they would basically talk philosophically
right.
about the larger context. You mm-hmm. know, the great thing about the relationship between Kirk and McCoy was that McCoy was the one person who could call Kirk on his BS.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You know, and he could just say, you know what, you're out of line here,
right.
and I'm the only one who could tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like Star Trek Beyond is sort of going back in that territory, and I'm really looking forward to that because I I thought that was kind of sorely missing out of the last two films.
I agree. And, you know, I think it's, you know, you could make, you know, talking to one of the writers, maybe they had to evolve that because this, you know, 2009 reboot was all them meeting and mm-hmm. then, you know, kind of build up their relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see it. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt that this has been a build up to.
Yeah, there's a lot of business to take care of.
Exactly.
Know, at least in those, you know, the first film.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I think that's wonderful. Well, thank you, Ben. Thank you, Nicole, for taking the time to share your Star Trek memories with
us. On anytime, the podcast today. Any geeky thing, we'll be happy to talk to you about.
That's great. This is the place to do it. I wanted to tell everyone who's listening to the podcast that the new issue of Famous Monsters is on newsstands now. You can get it at famousmonsters.com. You can get it on magster.com. It also contains some other really, really cool content, like exclusive interview with director James Cameron for the 30th anniversary of Aliens. Not bad.
not at all, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's pretty much a good get.
Yeah, totally.
Plus chats with the cast of The Conjuring 2 and Ghostbusters director Paul Feig.
Oh, cool.
I love Paul Feig.
Yeah, he gets an opportunity to sort of talk about the movie and the making of the movie, but also address, you know, how it might have perhaps been unfairly treated. Sight unseen.
Yes. Absolutely.
You know,
From the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, just too bad.
Yeah, I just think any movie worth its salt is worth at least a look before you judge.
Absolutely.
It could be awful. It could definitely be awful, but you should actually at least watch it first.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's hilarious gals in that. So.
Yeah. Or, you know, if you don't want to see it, maybe keep your opinion to yourself. That's my thought.
Yes.
But I know it was very...
That's what we've been doing.
I know it's very polarized. People are very, very passionate about this film. And totally. At least that's a discussion about movies. Other stuff that's on the issue, you've got Richard Donner talking about The Omen on the 40th anniversary of the movie. And also the 40th anniversary of Logan's Run came and went this summer. Oh, Michael, I sat down with Michael York, talked to Jenny Agutter.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it's pretty fun stuff. Patrick Duffy, pre-Dallas, he was the man from Atlantis.
I love it. Yeah.
And he has a new book that he wrote based on the character. And so he talks about that and reveals it.
Wait, it's a book? Based on the, so is it about his memoirs or that character?
It's a character that he wrote. So basically, it's the first in a planned trilogy of Harris stories written by Patrick Duffy.
Holy cow!
Wow!
And he really loved playing that character, and he feels that he owes his career to that character because that was his first big break. So everything that came after it, obviously Dallas was the huge thing, step by step, but. Yeah, so he sort of paid homage to that. He was like, you know, there was more that I could do with that character. Yeah. You can look for Famous Monsters number 286 with cool 50th anniversary Star Trek cover art by the amazing Rob Pryor. You can find that on Barnes & Noble. And
cool.
Nice.
Like I said, you can go to CaptainCo.com to get it online. And there's also lots of nifty Famous Monsters apparel and merchandise that you can get.
Nicole Allen has little newsboy hats on, passing it out in the corner of Hollywood and Vine, just in case. Yeah, exactly.
I also want to mention that there's a few days left on our Kickstarter project in celebration of Forrest J. Ackerman's centennial. FM's founding father would have been 100 this November, and we're doing a very cool comic book anthology called Tales from the Acker Mansion. It features a variety of original stories from very cool talent in the comic book movies world. Like John Carpenter, William Nolan, who wrote Logan's Run, and Richard Christian Matheson.
Wow.
You can get full details for that at famousmonsters.com or our imprint, AmericanGothicPress.com, or, of course, Kickstarter.com. Tales from the Acker Mansion will make its appearance this Halloween weekend at FM's first Alien Con.
Nice.
Heard about that.
Yeah, Alien Con is definitely going to be a fun thing. It's a major convention we're doing in partnership with History and A&E.
That's cool.
The first convention devoted to exploring space and the unknown. And it hinges on ancient aliens, which is, of course, is a very, very popular show with lots of popular theories.
And a callback to Nimoy's, what was that TV show?
In
Search of, exactly.
Yeah, very much so. So those guys are going to be there. Giorgio's going to be there. The stars of Ancient Aliens are going to be there.
Cool.
It's up in Santa Clara, California, the weekend leading up to Halloween, so Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Beautiful.
And it's going to be a big pop culture event. We're doing a big party on Friday night for Forry Ackerman Centennial,
nice.
Where we reveal the Tales from the Acker Mansion, and we have, you know, it's all about cosplay, right?
Yeah.
You know, obviously Halloween weekend, you dress up for Halloween,
absolutely.
But it is, of course, cosplay.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first convention devoted to exploring space and the unknown, with plenty of pop culture guests joining the stars of Ancient Aliens, including familiar faces from Farscape, Battlestar Galactica, Adama is going to be there.
Oh, nice, nice, nice.
Edward James Olmos. Lost in Space, the remaining cast of Lost in Space, and the robot is going to be there. Land of the Lost, there are some of the actors, you know.
Perfect.
Will, Holly, and Chaka are going to be there.
All three? Nice.
Yeah. And actors who are in both Alien and Aliens are going to be there. You know,
do you guys have like a real science or a NASA theme in that too?
Oh yeah, okay, yeah. Cool. I mean, it's not only just the pop culture of space, but it's the real and the perceived, because of course it's Ancient Aliens.
Yeah,
so that's
right.
either all true or all conjecture or a little of each. You know, Ancient Aliens is one of those amazing shows that no matter what you ultimately think about it, it definitely makes you think.
Totally.
You know, it definitely says, you know, there's something going on beyond the planet Earth and maybe on the planet
Earth.
Maybe
on. Yeah.
And that's a cool show because it explores that kind of stuff. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening to the Famous Monsters podcast. You can find Famous Monsters on all those social media channels, from Facebook and Instagram to Tumblr and YouTube and everything else. If you enjoyed this podcast and enjoy Famous Monsters magazine and our comics at American Gothic Press, please spread the word. Make sure to incorporate horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and genre pop culture into your conversations to ensure generations of monster kids to come. And so, everybody, until next time, live long and prosper.
Yes, yeah. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
The Famous Monsters podcast is copyright Famous Monsters and Movieland Classics, LLC, all rights reserved. The podcast is produced by Captured Aural Fantasy Theater. Find out more at CapturedAuralFantasy.com. That's Aural with an A-U and Fantasy with a P-H.